Today, on this episode of the PureDirect Special Spotlight.
Over the past few years, we've moved from a disease with very limited options to one where we have multiple therapeutic strategies like TTR stabilization, gene silencing, increasingly broader cardiometabolic approaches.
Today, Drs. Alexander and Witelis joined the podcast to discuss from early intervention to holistic care, ATTRCM, updates from ACC 2026, in this PureDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kevin Alexander, Assistant Professor of Cardiovascular Medicine at Stanford University in Stanford, California.
And I'm Dr. Ronald Witelis, Professor of Cardiovascular Medicine, also at Stanford University.
It's great to be here with you, Ron.
Pleasure's mine, Kevin.
So here we are at the American College of Cardiology 2026 Annual Scientific Session in New Orleans, and we've seen quite a few excellent presentations on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, or ATTRCM. Before we dive into the data, I think it's worth framing where we are today in ATTRCM. Over the past few years, we've moved from a disease with very limited options to one where we have multiple therapeutic strategies like TTR stabilization, gene silencing, increasingly broader cardiometabolic approaches. At the same time, a number of important questions remain. When is the optimal time to initiate therapy? How we should be monitoring disease progression in a way that truly reflects patient outcomes? And how we manage significant residual risk, particularly in patients with comorbidities like diabetes. So with that in mind, let's take a look at a few abstracts presented here at ACC that begin to address some of these key issues. You presented a post hoc analysis of patients with advanced disease from the HELIOS-B study of vutrisiran.
Yeah, thanks. So this is, I think, a pretty interesting study. We looked at vutrisiran in the HELIOS-B study, which, of course, was the trial that led to its approval for ATTR cardiomyopathy. Now, in HELIOS-B, patients were not allowed in if they had New York Heart Association Class 4 heart failure or the combination of New York Heart Association Class 3 heart failure plus NAC stage 3, which of course means an NT-proBNP above 3,000 and an estimated GFR below 45. However, so you couldn't have those to get in, but once you were in the trial, of course, some patients developed NYHA class 3 or NYHA class 3 plus NAC stage 3 or NYHA class 4 heart failure. So what we wanted to see is, how did vutrisiran affect the development of advanced disease using that definition? And then for the patients who did develop advanced disease, what happened? So first thing was that vutrisiran reduced the progression to advanced disease based on that definition. So 8% of the vutrisiran arm versus 10.7% of the placebo arm for roughly a 25% relative risk reduction. Now, if despite the fact, whatever you were on, you did develop advanced disease, vutrisiran showed a numerically lower risk of the composite of all-cause mortality and recurrent cardiovascular events where there was a hazard ratio of 0.6, all-cause mortality alone, where there was a hazard ratio of 0.44, and a similar benefit seen, in fact, even more profound, in the monotherapy group, that is, the group who was not on baseline tafamidis, with a hazard ratio of 0.23. That one was statistically significant. And there were fewer serious adverse events and discontinuations with vutrisiran versus placebo, likely because heart failure didn't progress as much. So from my perspective, in terms of the clinical practice implications, it supports the early initiation of therapy, in this case vutrisiran, to delay progression to advanced ATTR cardiomyopathy. But it also says that for those patients who do develop advanced disease, or frankly, maybe even start with advanced disease, you can still derive benefit from these therapies. Though the evidence obviously is post-hoc here and not definitive. It certainly reinforces the favorable safety and tolerability profile of vutrisiran, and it's relevant, I think, for long-term use. And the data may inform treatment decisions in those patients who are approaching or even at advanced stages, and who would not have been allowed in the clinical trial. It certainly, we know, highlights once again the need for the earlier diagnosis and treatment to maximize clinical benefit, because one fact we know about these drugs is that all of them have their greatest effect in patients with early disease.
Yeah, very interesting study. And I think that this is what helps us translate clinical trials into real-world practice. How do patients with more advanced disease do? How do earlier stage patients do? So in this study, I think it really gives us some important insights into how those more advanced stage patients and those that who progress, how they do. And vutrisiran clearly has a disease modifying effect, like you said.
Yeah, I think there's sometimes a nihilism that I've encountered among some where they say this person has advanced disease, they're too late. And undoubtedly, there is a too late. There's a point that somebody's entering hospice or that sort of thing. But I would not say just because your NT-proBNP is high and your EGFR is low that you should be restricted from getting any of these therapies. And this, I think, provides some good data to support that. Let me move on to another study, and this was looking at functional stability measured with 6-minute walk distance in patients treated with tafamidis versus placebo. And this was a post-hoc analysis from ATTRACT, that being the tafamidis and transthyretin cardiomyopathy clinical trial. So again, it's a post-hoc analysis of that phase 3 trial, ATTRACT, that was assessing the impact of 12-month functional stability on subsequent mortality and cardiovascular hospitalization. So to be clear, what's the definition of stability? Well, for this, we said if you did not reduce your 6-minute walk distance by more than 35 meters between month 0 and month 12, you were considered stable. So you could have gotten better, you could have stayed the same, you could have been up to 35 meters worse, but not more, versus the patients who worsened more than 35 meters on the 6-minute walk. And so then we said, okay, at that point, from month 12 to the end of the study, month 30, what happens? So what we found was this. First off, no surprise, more tafamidis patients than placebo patients had 6-minute walk distance stability at 12 months versus placebo. So 64% of the tafamidis arm were quote-unquote stable versus 53% of the placebo arm. What's more is that 6-minute walk distance stability with tafamidis treatment was associated with a markedly lower all-cause mortality versus patients who progressed, so a hazard ratio of 0.27 for all-cause mortality. There was also a trend towards lower mortality with the patients who were stable versus those who progressed, no surprise, also seen with placebo, that with a hazard ratio of 0.59. Tafamidis also reduced the cardiovascular hospitalization rates versus placebo, but this time actually more so in patients who had functional progression, and it was a 35% risk reduction. The functional decline was strongly associated with worse outcomes across both groups. So the clinical practice implications, I think, is that it reinforces 6-minute walk distance as a clinically meaningful marker of disease trajectory and prognosis in ATTR cardiomyopathy. It supports early treatment initiation, in this case with tafamidis, to preserve functional capacity and to improve survival. And it suggests that there's benefit of tafamidis even in patients with ongoing functional decline, particularly when it came to reducing cardiovascular hospitalizations. And it highlights the importance of monitoring functional status, HEROES with 6-minute walk test, to guide risk stratification and management. It really emphasizes the goal of maintaining functional stability, which we know is one of the key things for our patients beyond just survival, as a key therapeutic target in ATTR cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, interesting study, Ron. And so, you know, one of the things to me that a takeaway is, as we think about how to monitor disease progression and risk stratify, a lot of work that's been done with imaging and biomarkers, and those are important. But I think anchoring in functional parameters and as well as patient-reported outcomes is extremely important because, you know, even if patients live longer, these are the things that will affect their quality of life. And so getting a sense of things like 6-minute walk tests and outcomes is really important. And I wonder also too, you know, sometimes people say that they're, you know, how to translate this into broader practice. It's not always easy to do 6-minute walk regularly outside of a trial setting. But I think this is where wearables, for example, could play a role, where now we have the ability to really kind of non-invasively assess how patients are doing from a functional status standpoint, their step counts and kind of daily movement. It'd be really interesting to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point as these increase, particularly where we live, but I think are throughout the country and throughout the world. And I'll build on what you were just saying about how to measure progression. So a group of us published in JACC Heart Failure early this year a position statement about progression. And what we tried to do is define those characteristics that really have evidence from large cohort studies of being associated with survival. And we found there were 6 characteristics. It did not include any imaging characteristics. It did include biomarkers, as you referenced, but it also really included these functional measurements, including 6-minute walk distance. And for that, it was that same 35-meter change at 12 months.
Great. So I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about another interesting abstract presented at ACC. So glucagon like peptide 1 receptor agonist use and outcomes in transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy in patients with diabetes. This was a propensity matched analysis. So the authors here used a retrospective propensity match cohort from the Trinetics claims database and compared outcomes by GLP-1 use in patients with ATTR-CM and type 2 diabetes. We saw that GLP-1 use was associated with a significantly lower all-cause mortality with a relative risk of 0.4, relative risk reduction of 0.4. There's a reduced risk of major cardiovascular events, including MI, stroke, as well as a composite of MACE, and that relative risk reduction was 0.88. We saw that there are lower rates of heart failure exacerbation and arrhythmias. There was also reduced all-cause rehospitalization. So I think there's several practice implications here. This suggests in this claims database that there may be an incremental role for cardiovascular benefit in ATTR-CM patients and diabetes receiving GLP-1 agonists. And I think it builds on what we've seen, say, for the SGLT2 inhibitors, where we know that there's a benefit of those on top of disease-modifying therapies. This supports consideration of GLP-1s in patients who have a high composite of cardiometabolic risk. And this also raises the possibility that there's a dual benefit of metabolic and cardiovascular benefits in a population with limited options to mitigate that residual risk. I think it's important to highlight these data are hypothesis generating, and there's limitations with claims-based studies in terms of ascertaining ATTR diagnosis. You know, I think another interesting thing would be what the body mass index of these patients were, how many had concomitant obesity. But I think this requires, you know, further study, and hopefully we can get some more prospective data as these are becoming increasingly used in our cardiology patients. And it reinforces, and finally, it reinforces the importance of aggressive management of type 2 diabetes in patients with ATTR-CM.
Yeah, it's such an incredible world now where, you know, I think, as you said, even though we don't have an amyloid-specific trial, SGLT2 inhibitors are pretty universally used, I think, and at least anecdotally and from cohort studies, they pretty clearly show benefits. And it does make you wonder with the GLP-1s, which are obviously showing increasing cardiovascular benefits outside of the amyloid world. And I think this data is really intriguing.
Yeah, well, thank you, Ron. Overall, I think these studies really highlight how important it is to think early and proactively about managing ATTR-CM, both in starting treatment and in keeping a close eye on how patients are doing over time.
Yeah, I completely agree. They also point toward a more holistic approach where addressing comorbidities like diabetes may help us further improve outcomes beyond just the amyloid-targeted treatments alone. So thank you, Kevin.
And thank you to our audience for watching.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit SuperiorDirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@PeerDirect.com. Listen and subscribe to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, "What's my flash briefing?" Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Alexander and Witelis. Join me next time for the episode where we'll cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.